The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Well, first of all, we wanted to thank you and the others here at the library for inviting us to be here today. It's a great pleasure. And also to thank all of you for taking the time out of your day to be here with us so that we can discuss our new book with you. Our plan is to talk for about 25 or 30 minutes between ourselves. And then after that, we'd really like to hear from all of you, your questions, your thoughts, your comments about the information that we're discussing today. So I guess I don't need to tell you that we are all flooded with information about our health. It seems to come from all sides. You can't turn on the television or the radio without hearing a recommendation about what you should do or what you shouldn't do. And you can't pick up a newspaper or a magazine without seeing information about your health. But the problem is that the information is often conflicting. It seems that even the experts can't seem to agree about what's right and what's not right. So it's confusing. Confusing for patients and confusing for doctors, too. So how can you know what's the right thing for you to do? We realized ourselves as physicians and also when we're patients that we didn't really have the answer to that, to the question of how can you know what's right for you as an individual. So our search for an answer to that question led us to write this book.
We began the search by looking at textbooks. We're conditioned as doctors to always go back to the books. And there's what's called classical decision analysis, rational decision analysis, which is a method that was developed in economics to make judgments under uncertainty, mostly in terms of investments. In the past decades, this method has moved into medicine. And it's very, very widely adopted by health policy planners, insurance companies, and actually underlies many decisions that are made in Britain in the National Health Service. And it's based on a formula that actually was derived by Daniel Bernoulli. Some of you may remember way back in high school physics, the Bernoulli principle. Bernoulli was a polymath. He seemed to know everything about everything. And he figured out why birds fly. And he described wave theory. But he also was brought up in Holland when the Dutch were at the center of world commerce. And he said, you know, to make the best decision in business, you should look at the likelihood, estimate the probability or the likelihood of a certain outcome, and then the value of that outcome, which in economic terms boils down to money. How much money is going to be made and the impact the money has on your business. And that is a useful kind of approach. When it is imported into medicine, the first part, what is the likelihood of an outcome, you can get a rough approximation from clinical studies or epidemiologic studies of people with various disorders. The second part of the equation means you have to put a number on the experience of illness. You have to put a number on a medical condition. So in England, for example, they ask 3,000 healthy British citizens, imagine if you had diabetes, and on a scale from 0 to 1, how would that lower the quality of your life? How would that reduce the value of your life? And they do this for heart disease and so on. And it's widely done in the United States. And one of the questions they ask is, what if you became blind? And it turns out that when healthy people are asked this, they say, on a scale of 0 to 1, being blind is 0.5. It lowers the value of your life by half. Now, I happen to have a cousin who's blind. She's 63 years old. She was a premature birth. She was exposed to oxygen and has been blind for her life, basically. She speaks 4 languages. She worked as a teacher. She's a very active member of her synagogue. She's now retired from teaching, and she volunteers regularly helping elderly blind people, teaching some of them Braille if they never learned, reading to them, and so on. If you told my cousin that on a scale of 0 to 1, her life was a 0.5, she would slug you. Okay? There is no way for a healthy person to reduce the life of an individual with a medical condition to a number. But in fact, this is what is done in this analysis. And recently, a number of rather brilliant psychologists and cognitive scientists, among them Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize in economics, has said that this entire approach of using this formula in medical decisions is deeply, deeply flawed, even though it's actually being proposed to be a centerpiece of healthcare reform in the United States the same way it is in Britain. So the textbooks didn't give us the answer, and we weren't going to be able to understand how you make the best decision for yourself as an individual using a mathematical formula. So we recalled what William Osler, who was an eminent physician of the last century, said. He taught, when you're faced with a difficult problem and you're looking for an answer, listen to what the patient is saying. The patient's story is telling you the answer if you know how to listen. So we went back and over the course of several years interviewed scores and scores of patients all through the country, different socioeconomic groups, different jobs, different cultural backgrounds, different geographic areas, and we listened to their stories and we looked for answers.
So what we found was that different patients took different approaches to their medical decision-making. If you will, different medical minds were at play here. But there were common threads, and we found that some patients were what we called maximalists. So these people wanted to do everything and more to address any problem that came up. They wanted to be ahead of the curve and just go for whatever treatment was necessary to the maximum. And then at the other end of that spectrum were the minimalists. To those people, less is more. So they wanted to do just what was absolutely necessary to address their health and not anything more. And then we found another area where people diverged towards two ends of a spectrum, what we call technology orientation or naturalism orientation. So the technology orientation was wanting the latest cutting-edge technology, the latest, greatest breakthrough. And people who had a technology orientation wanted that. And people who had a naturalism bias preferred so-called natural treatments. So plant-based remedies, herbal remedies, acupuncture, massage, and things like this. And Dr. Gretchen Chapman out of Rutgers actually proposed a thought experiment that you could do to see if you were more of a technology orientation or a naturalism orientation. And she said, if you imagine that you're asked to take a particular treatment, and this treatment could be derived in the laboratory, or it could be derived from a plant, but it's identical. And if you think about that question for yourself, would you rather take something out of a laboratory or a plant-based natural remedy, but it's identical, chemically, structurally identical, then you can see where you might fall on that spectrum. And then finally, we had the believers and doubters. So the believers are people who believe there is a good solution to their problem. They just have to find it, and when they find it, they're going to go for it. And the doubters are people who are risk-averse. They're worried about side effects, unintended consequences. Maybe this treatment is going to be worse than the disease in the first place. So those were our three sort of orientations that we found as common threads when we talked to patients.
So one of the first patients we spoke with was a woman we call Susan Powell. We changed the names of all the patients in the book because we promised them confidentiality so that they could speak completely openly and honestly with us. And Susan is a woman in her mid-40s and follows a healthy diet, gets lots of physical activity, doesn't smoke, doesn't have high blood pressure. She actually works as a nurse's assistant. And on a regular checkup was found to have a high cholesterol level, 240. And her doctor said to her, well, you know, you're already following a good diet and you're already very vigorous and active. I'm going to prescribe a statin medication for you to lower your cholesterol. This will protect you by 30% from having a heart attack. Now, Pam just described for you the different medical minds, and Susan is a doubter. She's very worried about side effects, unintended consequences, and a minimalist. She told us, you know, when I have a headache, I just don't grab for Tylenol. I deal with it. People take too many medicines. I don't like having medications in my body unless I absolutely need it. But 30% protection from a heart attack caused her to pause. It sounded very impressive. But she didn't fill the prescription immediately. And she actually went on the internet and tried to trawl through. And she found a government site which has what's called a risk calculator. This helps you see where you are as an individual in the numbers. And a woman like Susan Powell, with a cholesterol of 240 and not a smoker, no high blood pressure, and so on, her risk for a heart attack, a non-fatal heart attack, over 10 years is 1 in 100. That means 99 people with a high cholesterol of 240, 99 women like her out of 100 do perfectly fine with no treatment. So she had discovered a very important question to ask to know where she is with all of these numbers, this flood of information that Pam talked about. What is the chance of this happening to me if I do nothing? And then she sat back and thought, you know, 30% of one is not as impressive as hearing you have a 30% reduction in risk, because our mind plays a trick on us. When someone says we're going to reduce your risk of a heart attack by 30%, you think you're at 100% risk, that you're destined to have a heart attack. But in her case, 1 in 100.
But there was more to Susan's story. So after she'd been given this prescription for the statin medication, she went to her church, and she happened upon a woman, a friend of hers, an acquaintance, who was hobbling around, barely able to move. So Susan went up to her and said, you know, what happened to you? What's the matter? And she said that she had been placed on the very same medication that Susan had been prescribed. And she'd had a bad side effect from it, inflammation of her muscles. So this is actually one of the most common side effects associated with this medicine. And of course, it's by chance that Susan happened upon her, but in her looking in the internet or asking other people, she probably would have come around to finding somebody who had had this side effect. So as somebody who was already risk averse, this had a really powerful impact on Susan and just made her really not want to take this medicine. So psychologists call the impact of stories availability, a powerful story that stays in your mind and is immediately available when you start thinking about the subject. So, and all of us are powerfully influenced by stories like this. So the effect of all these stories can be helpful. Sometimes it can help you know what you might be facing in terms of a medical problem or a treatment. But sometimes it can be really a negative thing because it can make you think that something that is very, very rare is common. So in the case of this particular side effect, if you look at the numbers, the side effect of muscle inflammation or muscle pain while on a statin occurs in between 1 and 10% of patients. So 10%, that sounds like a high number. But if you frame the numbers differently, the opposite way, we're going to flip the frame. So the same information can be given this way. Between 90 and 99% of patients have no problems with the medicine. That sounds better. So one of the important things to be aware of is that when you hear a story, you have to integrate it with the numbers. And when you hear the numbers, you have to be careful how the numbers are presented. You have to see how they're framed, and it's important, if you can, to flip the frame and make sure you're looking at it in both a positive way and a negative way.
So Susan knew what her risk for a heart attack was without any treatment. She better understood what her doctor was really saying by a 30% reduction in risk. And as Pam said, she took a story which was frightening to her, but put it in the context of how frequently do people have these side effects from the medication. And as a doubter and as a minimalist, she sat back and said no. Despite the expert advice, despite clinical guidelines that I should take a statin, I'm not taking the drug. Now, is she irrational, crazy, obstinate, non-compliant? We don't think so. The Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Science says that the pinnacle of what should be termed quality care is informed patient preference. You should be informed, but to truly be informed means you understand how the information applies to you as an individual, your particular characteristics in terms of your own condition, and informed patient preferences. We've set out a set of categories after all of this research and discussion with patients to understand preferences, where people's orientations come from. And she was a doubter and a minimalist. Now, interestingly, there was a study done by researchers from Dartmouth, published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, home base here in Philadelphia, that took a large group of people and showed them information about Susan's dilemma. Should I take a statin drug for a high cholesterol level? When they gave the people information the way it's typically presented, especially in drug advertising, it was very difficult for people to be truly informed. When they created what's called a drug fact box, when they presented the information just the way we did in Susan's case to this group, people really understood the actual benefit and risk of treatment. But what's so interesting is that contrary to what experts say, which is that once you as a patient are informed, you will do what the experts think is best. There was a tremendous diversity in people's choices within this group. The better they understood, the more informed they were. The doubters and the minimalists said, no way. And then the maximalists and the believers said, not only give me statin, but, you know, give me a higher dose. And then there was a middle. And so medicine is a gray zone. There is no one way, one right answer for everyone. Because as Pam said in the introduction, even the experts disagree. There are experts who believe that the current guidelines about cholesterol and statin are wrong. Gilbert Welch up at Dartmouth, who's a very credible guy, thinks there's over-treatment. Norton Hadler, University of North Carolina. Colleagues of ours at Harvard in the cardiology departments think you should be taking higher doses and driving the cholesterol down even more. So the reason experts disagree and give you conflicting advice is not because they're looking at different numbers. They all have the same information. It's because they are projecting their own medical mind onto the recommendations.
So you might ask, why is it important to know your own medical mind? Why can't you just make your decision the way you make it and that's it? Well, let me use myself as an example. Like Susan Powell, I fall into the minimalist and doubter frame of mind. Even as a doctor, I have my doubts. So when I go to my doctor and my doctor says to me, you need to take this or do this test, my immediate response is, I don't want that. I really don't want that. I'm afraid it's going to make, you know, it's going to have some side effect that I'm, you know, that I don't need, or I'm going to have some problem related to the procedure. So I know that. I acknowledge that about myself. And then I inform myself. I look at all the numbers, all the statistics, gather as much information as I can about the issue, and then I reevaluate my decision. Am I right? Is my first impulse correct? Maybe I should rethink this. So in some cases, I'm going to stay right where I started, and in some cases, I'm going to say, you know what? You were maybe overly influenced by your basic mindset, or maybe even a story that I heard, or a patient who had a side effect that was my patient, so that's available in my mind, and it's influencing me unduly. And then I might move over on the spectrum back towards maybe a little more maximalist or believer.
I'm a believer and a maximalist. I say...
Yet we have lived together, married for 32 years.
32 years. But I'm in recovery, as I say. But that is my fundamental mindset. And in the book, actually, we give you a way, a process for you to look into yourself and understand where your own medical mind came from, what influenced it, what evolved, how it evolved. But just as Pam said, my first impulse, my belief is there's got to be an answer. And it's going to come from science and technology, and it's going to be done to the maximum. And that mindset led to the signature mistake of my life. And that is that a number of years ago, I was a very avid runner, and I developed excruciating back pain. I didn't have a blown disc. It wasn't clear where it was coming from. But I was sure there had to be a solution. And it had to be an aggressive solution because the pain was so bad. And I had a back surgery, which was a catastrophe. Now, I never really understood my mind and my process in terms of why I made that choice until we worked on the book together. And it's because I didn't have the words. I didn't have the language. We understand ourselves and our world. We understand our choices through language, through terms. I hope that if I had known that I was such a believer, and a maximalist, that I would sort of be in the mirror image of what Pam just said, that natural impulse to keep pushing and thinking I'm going to do it, it's got to be done, there is a solution, it's going to be fixed, I could step back and say, is that really corresponding to my individual condition? And perhaps I would have taken a more moderate approach. So what we're offering in the book, and we see the book as a contribution, is to give each individual a framework to understand how this flood of information, to navigate through it, and understand what applies to you and what doesn't apply to you. And you know, this is not rocket science. The key is to find the numbers that are relevant to you. It's not complicated math. It really isn't. When it's presented in a complicated way, it's confusing. In fact, there's a recent study that shows it's confusing not only to patients but to doctors. The doctors are trying to make sense out of it. So just like in Susan's case, we show how to simply get to the numbers you need and then how to figure out your medical mind. And that way, you're not making decisions blindly, but you're making them with awareness of information and yourself. And hopefully then you have confidence that you made the right decision for you. Thank you.
Thank you very much to the good doctors for their presentation. At this point, if you have a question, please raise your hand. We will get a microphone to you. Please limit it to one question. I have a feeling there will be many. Gentleman in the black back there, the mic's on the way.
At the beginning of your talk, you mentioned the inundation of information and advertising and so forth. I'm just wondering, it seems to me that the patient wanting to be informed is barraged with these commercials that occur at prime time. Drug companies are spending millions or tens of hundreds of millions to advertise in a way that makes you feel that if you take the medication, you're going to be running on the beach with your dogs and out on a canoe in the lakes and so forth. And this advertising seems to me to be very powerful because it says, then go ask your doctor if you should take such and such. So you go to your doctor, and he says, yeah, you know, that I think it would benefit you and so forth. So it seems like a conspiracy more in the direction of taking the drugs than in taking a different approach, because you just feel that you want this lifestyle that's being advertised. Even if you realize that it's advertising, I think subliminally, over time, the number of ads has this result. I just wondered what your thoughts are about that. Thank you.
I think that's a wonderful question. So you're right. One of the most powerful effects on us are stories, as I mentioned. And the drug companies and the advertisers for the drug companies know this. So what they do in the advertisements is to give you a story, a very nice story about somebody who is has a wonderful life because of their medicine. And that story stays in your mind and is available when you're thinking about this whole subject. You see this beautiful garden, and they're having a birthday party and a picnic, and the grandchildren are there. So that's very powerful, and I think availability is a lot of that. But one of the interesting things I think about these drug ads is that some people, when they look at it, the doubters, even though they see the garden and the birthday party, they're listening very carefully to the side effects as they scroll down. Muscle pain, stomach upset, death, you know, all these terrible side effects. So different people have different responses to these advertisements, but you're completely right that the goal is to utilize these stories and put them in your head so you want the medication. That is the goal, and that's what advertising is all about.
To continue, and exactly as Pam said, for the believers and the maximalists, what they do is they distract you when they say the side effects. So I've looked at some of these ads now with open eyes. So when the woman is in the garden cutting roses, it says it can cause seizures and death and this and that. But you're focused on the fact that she looks great and she's cutting roses and she's going to give them to her grandchildren. We found in the research in the book that in 2009, $5 billion was spent on drug ads in the United States. That's twice the entire budget of the FDA. That there are an average TV viewer who's not like a TV addict but watches the evening news and maybe a morning show and something on prime time sees 1,000 drug ads.
Which translates into 16 hours per year of drug advertising. And I don't think many of you spend 16 hours a year with your doctor. So it's powerful.
Has there been a study of the efficacy of the ads other than anecdotal evidence?
Yes.
There has.
So the efficacy is from the business side. Every $1,000 spent in drug ads translates into 24 new prescriptions. So, you know, these ads on prime time cost a lot of money. It's not $1,000. Right. It's tens of thousands or more. Or ads, you know, I mean, the Super Bowl ads are enormous. Mm-hmm. So 24 prescriptions for $1,000. That's why there's so much advertising.
Yeah, they work.
They work.
Another question. Right here in the third row, gentleman in the gray shirt.
Thank you.
It's on.
Is that on? Okay. I have the same complaint of, ask a doctor, and this is coincides with the fact that the doctor now looks in any visit is 10 minutes, at least 8 have spent looking at the computer, and there's 2 minutes left to ask your doctor something about something. Even more disturbing than this, what I find, I see the ads all the time on the television, but I go to my doctor's office and I see a clock from some drug company and I see a calendar from another drug company, something wall thing, pencils. Shouldn't the medical profession cleanse itself by not accepting this sort of advertising? It has a much greater effect if you see this in the doctor's office than if you see it between a couple of other commercials on the television.
So can I address the first part of that question? So the first part of the question was that you only get a few minutes with your doctor, and that's true. That's the way medicine has been moving. And it's probably the most frustrating part for patients, but also for doctors, that we want to be able to spend the time to understand our patients. People go into medicine feeling that it's a calling. They want to, you know, be there for their patients and be their advocates and do the right thing. But the way medicine is moving these days in terms of efficiency, it's becoming more and more difficult. So I want to acknowledge that that's a real issue, and the computer issue is just making it that much more difficult when a lot of the time has to be spent doing computer work, even more difficult for us as physicians and for you as patients, or for me as patient when I'm there too. So an important issue, and we are all struggling with that. Maybe you want to address the second part
well,
of it.
But to Pam's point there, what we believe is this is now the reality of the system. We want to change it and we want to fight against it, but all of us are trapped in it. And so one of the benefits we hope of the book is that before you go to your doctor, you have a framework of understanding of your medical mind, and you also have the key questions to ask. The questions that often aren't found easily, like what is my chance as an individual if I do nothing? What is the real impact? You're a more effective patient if you come with this level of understanding, if you know your medical mind, and you can use those words to communicate to your doctor what your, quote, preferences are, how you want to approach your health. So within the confines, the frustrating confines of time, you become a more effective patient, we hope. with this new knowledge and this self-awareness. Now, the People's Republic of Massachusetts has outlawed direct gifts to doctors from drug companies. Okay? And this includes not only what you see with the calendars and all of that, but the pizza lunches for the interns and residents to start them there, and the gourmet meals, for get-togethers. We're not against drug companies per se. We wouldn't have treatments if there were no drugs. You know, I'm a cancer specialist. We need good drugs for people with cancer, but they have to be good drugs, and they have to be marketed and explained in an honest and transparent way.
Is there a movement toward that? Is there a consumer group that's pushing the drug companies toward that?
There is a consumer group, and importantly now, there's a big move about conflict of interest. The Institute of Medicine of the National Academy, which is sort of the umbrella group for, advising policy, believes, for example, one of the most important things is that expert recommendations. Many of the committees have people who are consultants to drug companies. Now, it's not that they're whores, per se, but they're believers, and it's impossible to dissociate the fact that you're getting funding not to sort of advocate for that particular treatment. Right. So they are recommending that people on these committees not have a financial interest, and we believe it's the right way to go.
Let's see, gentleman right in front, and then we'll move toward the back.
A little bit about generic. Sorry. Could you speak to the subject of generic drugs and their efficacy and their regulations, how they get approved, and perhaps are they made in clean places, manufacturing section?
I'll speak to that. Anyone who didn't hear the question was about generic drugs. Are they equivalent? So this is a complicated subject. There are experts disagree. The government and various agencies do regulate these generic drugs within certain parameters and test them very carefully to be sure that they are equivalent before they approve them. That said, there are certain drugs where the equivalence is not completely accepted by every expert, and this remains an area of some controversy. So certain medications seems that generic substitutions are fine, and other drugs there's more controversy about.
In your own field, you might want to...
Absolutely. In my own field of endocrinology, the preparations of thyroid hormone, there are very credible experts who feel that the generic substitution is acceptable and others who feel that it is not.
There is information from two sources. One is the package insert or the FDA website. But in terms of the controversy, and there is real controversy, the place to look at is often the specialty societies. So there's the Endocrine Society, the
American Thyroid Association, and they on their websites they will have information about this.
And there'll be a point-counterpoint. Mm-hmm. This again is a gray zone. Mm-hmm. All of us would like things to be black and white and to have certainty. We're more comfortable with certainty. But we feel that when you understand the uncertainty that you face, you're actually more empowered because then you know your eyes are open and you try to make the best decision you can.
Right back here, the gentleman in the fifth row in the brown shirt, yes.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. It's such a treat to see a face to go with the writing, and I'm pleased to meet your wife. I'm sure we all are. And as a diabetic, hello, endocrinologist. I'm thinking about all the people who aren't in this room, who don't read the book, who don't subscribe to the New Yorker, who don't go to the library, who work for a living or survive for a living, and don't have this ability. I recently diagnosed with my first cancer. I end up at the Mayo Clinic website where there's a real simple Q&A, and it's a diagnostic one, just like you learn, you know, when you take your medical exam. You are given the information, and then you pick a diagnostic path, which happens to be, in your case, as a potential patient, a symptom, and you follow it down, and then it gives you what the likely results are. And, of course, the top of the list was cancer, which I wasn't about to believe. So I started at the other end of the list with diabetic neuropathy of the villi in the colon, you know, things that I was too well informed about to make the sensible decision. So I lost, you know, 3 or 4 weeks of diagnostic by misleading myself. What about the people who even with a tool like the Mayo Clinic, wouldn't have access to this? Can we simplify it in some way? You mentioned a risk factor at the government website. Right. Are there such things that are rolled out as part of, you know, socialized medicine, as part of regular information that goes to a Social Security patient or a Medicare patient and so on that just says, use this to check up on things, something universal?
Right. I think studies show now that almost 70% of all people use the Internet looking for, you know, and even people of limited resources have, especially the next generation, of course, you know, our kids are completely computer literate and you know, digital and all of that. But there are these risk calculators, and there are these very helpful government websites that help organize information, and you can work through this. The math is truly like second grade. It's really easy. It makes it easy for me, and I'm happy with second grade math. So that is a very important place to go. But I also think that, as Pam said, doctors, you know, they really want to do the best. And within the system, there are many constraints. So the more that you know, we're not putting the burden or the onus on the patient to do the work, per se, but to try to create a partnership with your doctor. And there are times where I don't know what's wrong with someone. I've gone to the end of my intellectual capability. And I think getting a second opinion, and if you don't have the resources to go to the Mayo Clinic, if you live in an urban center, there are a lot of outstanding teaching hospitals. You can go a mile away and seek another opinion. In terms of the system, though, what concerns us is that there may well be limitation in freedom of patients to seek care from different doctors. Recently in Massachusetts, they're introducing a lot of the community hospitals were bought by a for-profit corporation. And so they're marketing now an insurance product to businesses, mostly for blue-collar workers, where they essentially cannot go to a teaching hospital. And if they do, they have to pay $1,000 more, which is a lot of money for a lot of people. And the name of the insurance is called Patient Choice.
That's why language is important.
Another question. Gentleman off to our left here and to your left.
My question has to do with the issue of end-of-life care and how you understand the patient's mind as it approaches the end of life.
So this is an important question, too, and we address it in the book. People talk a lot about having a directive so that you have made in advance the decisions about end-of-life care, whether you want heroic measures or whether you don't want them. And this is an important thing to do, but we view it as only a starting point, not the end of the discussion. Because in the book we talk about a woman who had specified no heroic measures, and then when she started her treatment, she changed her mind. And in fact, she's not alone in that. Studies have shown that as many as 50% of all patients who've already had a directive in advance will change their mind. And that's because it's very hard to anticipate what you're going to feel at that time. You've never experienced it. So it's not an easy process. It's a dynamic and changing process. And it's important, once you initiate the conversation, to keep the conversation going. Would you like to add to that?
So we actually devote two chapters to this in the book because it's such an important point. And as Pam says, it's a dynamic, changing process. And what do heroic measures mean? So, for example, we talk about, say, someone has lung cancer and they might live 2 years. But they develop a heart problem, which requires, say, giving them oxygen through a respirator for a week. But then they're going to get better, presumably, and could live 2 years. But people say a heroic measure. I don't want to go on a breathing machine. I don't want to be on a ventilator. Does that apply to this case? So sort of a general format often becomes more challenging with the clinical specifics. The second issue is for people who no longer can think for themselves. They're in coma or they're on very high sedative medications and so on. And then what occurs is called substituted judgment. Whoever's designated in the living will or the advance directive as the proxy is supposed to make a choice as though that person could make the choice himself or herself if they were awake and competent. Now, that is really hard. And research shows that often the proxy makes a choice which ends up different than the one the person would have made for himself or herself. So it's very complicated. It requires an ongoing, evolving discussion. But again, with language, we hope that if the family members or the proxy in the living will and the advance directive think about these categories of medical mind, is the person in coma, was he a minimalist or a maximalist? Was he a believer or a doubter? Was he into all of this high-tech machinery that's in the ICU or not? And again, it's not perfect. You can't substitute and get into the person's mind, but it gives you a better understanding from his life story, his philosophy, and then you can be truer to what he or she may have chosen if they had been able to.
Time for a few more questions. I see we have a lot of them, but we'll just get to a few. Lady in the green all the way back on our left. And folks, I apologize. Apparently there's some construction going on and they're unaware that we have an event today.
I've been thinking about the doubter versus the non-doubter, the believer. And even more than doubt, I go into high fear. And so what I'm wondering is, have there been any studies that show effective ways to handle your fear if you were in a medical situation?
How to handle fear. You can tell that we're very both individual and psychological. And one of the, in terms of thinking about people's minds and their values, one of the people in the book is a psychologist who spent his whole career thinking about thinking and people's feelings and emotions and challenge of fear. And he is told at the age of 60 that he has prostate cancer. And this is a very common diagnosis given to men. About almost 250,000 men a year in the United States. And he is terrified. And that terror initially almost makes him jump to do a maximal immediate treatment to just get it over with. But fortunately, his wife and to some degree his own training helps bring him back. So I think one way to deal with fear is to express it. There's nothing wrong with being afraid. We're all afraid at different points in life. And so you reach out to either a loved one whom you trust and knows you, or if you need a professional help as a psychologist or a psychiatric social worker, or you express your fear to your doctor who hopefully has more than 7 minutes to respond to you or to find someone who can help you, this is really critical because he talks, he gives beautiful language in the book of how vulnerable and terrified he felt and confused. And those feelings almost pushed him in a direction which could have been wrong for him. And ultimately he found an equilibrium and he made a choice that was right for him.
Can I add to that also? I'll give you a case that was someone that I saw who had a thyroid cancer, and she was terrified of the surgery, refused the surgery. And I could not understand why. It was a reasonably safe surgery and it would have been curative. And finally, this came down to a story. She had been impacted by a terrible story of somebody who had had thyroid surgery and had a horrible result. And that once we got that out, once we explored why she was so afraid, we were able to get past it, and she was able to go ahead and have the right treatment. So it's possible that just kind of thinking about where that fear comes from might be able to help you get past it.
A few more. Let's see, who do we have? Gentleman in the blue here, and then we'll go to the fellow in the striped shirt on the aisle, Rosetta. Yep. Keep your hand up, sir, so we can get you the mic. Thank you.
Given your polar personalities here, would you tackle placebo and placebo effect, how that can skew an outcome of a study that is interpreted without science but yet has a positive effect? I mean, this is a tough one in drug studies, I understand.
Yeah. I actually looked at this in the past in a book called The Anatomy of Hope, and it's amazing. The placebos are extremely powerful. The belief that the pill you're getting may help you, for a believer, can cause marked reduction in pain or joint immobility. I mean, there was a study that was done in the Veterans Administration Hospital. Maybe that's the only place they could get away with this. But they took people with arthritic knees. Half the group had arthroscopic surgery. The other group they took to the operating room. And they made little cuts on the side of the knee. And the nurse, who was part of the study, said, okay, now we're putting in the arthroscope, and she's sloshing water around. Oh, it looks great. We're cutting all the debris out and all that, and nothing was being done. Okay? And, of course, the patient is up, you know, his head is up like this, and, you know, so he thinks he's had knee surgery. The outcome in improvement of function of the knee, mobility, and reduction in pain was equivalent between the two. Okay. Now, there is, though, something called a nocebo effect for the doubters. So what you also find is that there's a fraction of people in placebo studies who get sick on the placebo.
Yeah,
I'm having terrible side effects.
They have the side effect.
They have the side effects. And there is, it's inert. Okay? And, in fact, you know that magazine, The Onion, that humorous magazine, our kids used to read it all the time? They had a headline, FDA outlaws placebos is too powerful. So there is and this, of course, is the great debate about antidepressants and so on. There's a big debate there. So there is one other thing to mention, because this gets to the point of how to interpret scientific studies because they are not done in the real world. And there's something called the Hawthorne effect. The Hawthorne effect means when you get a group of people together in a study, regardless of the treatment they get, they all do better. Because guess what? You're not spending 5 minutes with them. They're in a research study. So they have a research nurse, and they have a data coordinator, and they have a physician who is interviewing them and following them and calling them at home and so on. So the actual participation in the research improves their care. So one of the great challenges is translating, because we've done these studies our entire academic lives as doctors in a teaching hospital, is to take this group of patients within the sort of crucible of a research trial and then to try to say, okay, how do those findings apply or don't apply to the real world in the doctor's office?
And final question, gentleman in the back.
Thank you. This is more a thank you comment. I'm a primary care researcher working in family medicine here in Philadelphia. And one of our research interests are in health beliefs of patients, their motivation to seek therapy, their beliefs about their disease and the placebo, end-of-life care, all this kind of stuff. Sounds really like a link to what you are interested in. And just one little thing from one of our studies in asthma, how can you predict who's going to take their inhaled corticosteroids? If the patient believed they were a partner with their physician in deciding about their care, that was a very, very potent predictor. And we don't think that health beliefs are going to cure every disease, but they're incredibly important for tailoring care. And so thank you very much for enlightening us about this. And it was the Hawthorne Electric Company for anybody who wants to win a bet at their next cocktail party.
Well, thank you for that.
Thank you for that.
Absolutely. Well, and thank you all. Thank you.
Thank you.
So if you give us a few minutes to get upstairs, we will see you. There are books, and the good doctors will be signing. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.